to Glam City. On Glam City, we speak to the hardworking people working in Australia's galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. I'm Chelsea Barnett, and today we are doing things a little bit differently. We're turning the tables because one of our own is in the hot seat. We are chatting to Dr. Kira Lindsay, and she's usually the other host, the co-host of Glam City, but today she's the subject. She's who I'm going to be chatting to and questioning. Kira is an Australian Research Council DECRA Fellow, the University of Technology, Sydney, and she's the author of the 2016 book, The Convict's Daughter, which, if I'm correct, is in its sixth print run.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe six or seventh by now, yeah.
As somebody else who has a book that is not in its sixth or seventh print run, that is quite amazing. So today we're going to chat about a bit of a gem, something that you found in the archive and about which you've recently written a piece in the conversation. So we're going to be talking about these ladies' petitions from 1850. And so a little bit of context in order to stop the recommencement of transportation, which mm-hmm. was the sending of convicts from Britain to the colony, mm-hmm. to New South Wales.
Yep.
There were a whole bunch of rallies and protests and petitions.
Right. So 1840, transportation stops in New South Wales, but not elsewhere, of course, not in Western Australia and not yet in Tasmania. And the colony really sees it as this great opportunity to start to grab the reins and the purse strings of self-government. You know, so it will be able to run the economy and decide the future of not just New South Wales, but, you know, we know that Parkes thought that New South Wales was really, Henry Parkes was really how you, the engine room for the whole of Australia. So there was that kind of local but also a national vision. So within a decade, they colonists in New South Wales had made amazing progress, and they really felt in 1848 that they were just on the brink of all these of greater self-government. And at that moment, the colonial secretary, who was in charge of all the dominions in the British Empire, basically all the territories, basically said, "I think it's time to resume transportation to New South Wales." Well, that went down, to quote Barry Humphreys, like a cup of cold sick in New South Wales. People didn't like the idea because they felt that they had finally purged the convict stain, even though there were still convicts serving their sentences throughout the colony. But they felt that they had acquired a level of respectability that would make them fit for government. And so when Earl Grey actually sent a ship called the Hashmi, he sent it to Sydney. And when it got here in the winter of 1849, and I've written about this in The Convict's Daughter, in fact, it's the backdrop against the which my that story plays out. Thousands of colonists rushed down to Circular Quay and stopped the boat.
Wow.
So it was not able to dock in Sydney. And so colonists felt victorious. They yeah. felt that they had had their statement and sent a firm message to the colonial secretary that there would be no convicts here. But what happened was that Governor Fitzroy, who was a bit of a lad, rather slippery and very old school, he basically downplayed the significance of this moment of public protest and wrote back to the colonial secretary saying, "Ah, it was just a few rabble-rousers that no one takes seriously. Forget about it." And so the colonial secretary was forgetting about it, and he was just about to send another boat. And when colonists in New South Wales heard that Governor Fitzroy had basically done the dirty on them, they were absolutely livid. And it's that stirred up this ferment. Now, there had been fermentation about this issue for over a decade, particularly from 1846 onwards, but it had been growing, you know, festering. People thought it was resolved, and really they thought that Hashmi episode down at Circular Quay had done the job. Mm-hmm. And so they were now sleeves rolled up and ready to go. And that is why what you had at this moment was not just your old radical rabble rousers with, you know, the vision of democracy in their eyes, but you had people who were invested in this for different reasons, people from the upper classes as well as previous convicts as well. All of them just felt like the colonial secretary didn't have a right to disregard their desires. And if he was going to do that, he was disrespecting local authority, but also the whole tenet of what British governing systems were being. So they wanted the colonial secretary to be sacked for this, and they wanted to have a say in how the colony would be run in the future. So there's a lot at stake here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You can kind of see it as one of the early moments of an expression of independence. You know, back off and let us make our own decisions about what we think is right for ourselves.
And so this is where the petition comes to light,
that's
I suppose.
Right. Yep.
And part of what is so remarkable about the petition, which you've got copies sitting in front of us, mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to see that kind of gorgeous old handwriting and see the lists, the list of different communities that were signing on to this. What's so remarkable about this is that part of the people who were signing onto that were women.
Right, and not just women, Chelsea, but as you know, as I say in the conversation piece, what I did when I crunched these the figures, so 9,189 women in Sydney alone signed that petition. There were two petitions, so those signatures across those, but they were all consolidated into one document when they were tabled in Legislative Council and then sent off to the House of Commons in England. To go to the Queen.
Yes.
Which was their ultimate, because the petition was actually addressed not to the parliamentarians, but to Queen Victoria. And I love that. I love the fact that you've got these colonial women talking to their Queen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's fantastic. So, petitions were also circulated from the Conservatives who wanted to maintain transportation. They got under 600 signatures, whereas Henry Parkes and his team collected well over 32,000 signatures. Now, of those signatures, we have the 9,000 or so from Sydney women. And what that tells you, I think, if you start to think about those figures, is that within Sydney alone, there was a very active female public, collective, because they were a considerable number of those total signatures. They're about a third, just a little less than a third.
And I think you say 42% of Sydney's female population,
mm-hmm.
which is, again, not a small kind of chunk of things. It's quite a sizable portion
right.
of the women living in Sydney at the time.
That's it. And I was just so excited because, you know, I've been brung up proper, as we might say, as a 19th century historian. And we read all these things, which I think have been challenged over the last decade or so, about this idea of the separation of the spheres. You know, the idea that this kind of doctrine became very popular was articulated by people like John Ruskin, in fact, who I'm writing about in my current book, she said, plugging it, and about this idea that men should be in the hostile, adversarial public sphere and women could be the goddesses of the hearth in the domestic sphere. Now, I think that there's a lot of elements of truths of that broad idea, but what we see here is something that completely shows us that these women were not entirely confined to that sphere. In fact, that's the language that one of the people who present the petition says. The women are entitled to step out of their sphere.
Wow.
Into this sphere for something that matters. And in fact, not only are they entitled, it's their right to do it. And I love this language, you know. Can you imagine how exciting that is? So if we know that they weren't confined to that sphere, we also know that we now, I think, have to say, well, they weren't confined, but also they weren't entirely excluded from their political processes. In fact, in this particular instance, people like Henry Parkes and all the people who were working with him worked with the women to invite them into the political sphere and to get this petition signed. It was them using their campaign techniques to get these signatures.
That's really interesting because you say in the conversation piece that the press snidely described, it's a great phrase, snidely described the petitions as lady petitions, mm. and yet you've got Parkes kind of legitimating, I suppose, or confirming the legitimacy of this the women's activism by inviting them in. Does that speak to, I suppose, a kind of disconnect between how women more broadly were imagined or expected to act in colonial New South Wales and actually what they were able to do, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think it's a reminder that issues of gender are never going to be cartoonesque. You know, there's always going to be a lot of complexity in that story. I mean, I hasten to add, I don't think that we should be turning Henry Parkes into a pin-up boy for, you know, colonial feminism, because he really wasn't. And, you know, it was clearly to his political advantage to do this. But what they did do, and this is what I discovered when I looked at the document itself, you know, I went through every single page. On the back of each page, there's the name of the signature collector. And they used the same techniques as they used for the male petitions. They created this beautiful document, I think, with the very strong input from women in the actual address. And then they got their typical campaigners to go around and knock on the doors and get these signatures. Now, I know that because not always, but in quite a few instances, you see the addresses of where these women live. And this, I think, is incredibly exciting for potential future research. You know, we could do some great, I'd love to get a PhD on board and supervise that, to do a project that cross-referenced this with social history, cultural history, political history, convict files, literary records, things about literacy, and really, for the first time, bring these women out of the shadows of Sydney's social history.
It also, I suppose, speaks to the complexity of not only political activism in colonial New South Wales, but women's political kind of activism engagement. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
You know, the kind of arch villain of that piece that I wrote in the conversation is William Charles Wentworth, who had started off his life, his political career rather, as a radical for the native born, you know, pushing the rights of first generation European born Australians and making the case for the fact that those people had a kind of distinctive birthright and in the colony, but at least a right to have their voice and their opinions not disregarded by the sterling set. But by the time we see him, this old shambolic corduroy wearing man who tried to buy, who bought New Zealand at one stage. I mean, he is one of the most wealthy people in Australia, and he's a squatter par excellence. He's the man that you want to think about, and he's become about as conservative as it can be. He has, you know, his wife, who's been subject to a difficult time within colonial society herself, and many, many daughters. But Wentworth says in this, when the petitions, these ladies' petitions are, sorry, when I use the word ladies' petitions, I put it in those quotation marks as well, because I think it is a pretty disparaging term. So what the correct title is, Petitions from the Female Inhabitants of Sydney, but that's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
So we'll say the petition from the women. Anyway, he says, oh, well, you know, if you're going to let petitions like this in, which I don't think we should, but if you're going to let petitions like this in, watch out, because, you know, before you know what's happening, there'll be great big loads of petitions on the Legislative Council table and they will be agitating for women's rights.
So this was like the gateway petition. He saw it.
Yeah. He said, this is the beginning of a great big flood. And he said, watch out, husbands, if you're letting your wives sign this document, then you're not going to get your shirts ironed, you're not going to get your meals cooked. I mean, it was about as disgusting. It's real fingers in the mouth stuff from Wentworth. And that's when John Lamb says, actually, these women have an absolute right, not even a right, but a duty to step out of their sphere and into this world to make these statements. So, you know, when we look at the question of gender, you've got three men giving us an insight into this. We've got Parkes saying, I want to use these women for my political advantage because the cause matters. Mm-hmm. You've got Lamb saying, these women have a right and duty. And then you've got Wentworth saying, look out, the spirit of Mary Wollstonecraft is stirring in Sydney. Before we know it, you know, they'll be telling women that they shouldn't be looking after their husbands. Heaven forbid should that
happen. Heaven forbid. I think Wentworth would be looking down on us right now, women in the room chatting, with a smile on his face, surely. Just to kind of, I suppose, step it out a little bit, you work on what you call speculative biography, and your current DECRA project is the speculative biography of Adelaide Ironside. Can you tell me just, you know, a little bit more about Adelaide herself?
Well, and Adelaide is the person that we should thank for finding this petition as well. So I'm very glad that we've brought her into the room with us today, Chelsea. So Adelaide Eliza Scott Ironside.
It's a name.
Mm-hmm. And she introduced the name Scott when she was 13 or 14. She was, I guess you'd have to say, she was a bit of a child prodigy in some ways. At least that's how she was described. Her grandmother had been a convict who was transported for forgery in 1812. And her grandfather, now this is a bit contentious, there's a difference of opinion about this, but my biography will, I think, make compelling the argument that her grandfather was John Redman, who was a Marine with Watkin Tench, who came out on the Charlotte within the First Fleet, got involved in all sorts of mischief and ended up being the chief watch keeper of Sydney and then the chief jailer at George Street. So they were there from the very inception. Some people have described them as colonial royalty, but they weren't. So Adelaide's, her mother left her father short when she was about three because of his drinking. And so she was brought up by a single mother who was quite ambitious. Now, forgery at this time was a crime of the upper classes and the educated. So although Mary Redman, her grandmother, is a shadowy figure, I think we can recognise that there must have been a tradition of educating accomplished women. And that's what Adelaide became. She could speak three or four languages. She wrote a lot of poetry, which was published in newspapers. And she did this incredible collection of 43 Australian wildflowers that were exhibited in France to great acclaim. And that set her off to become the first Australian-born artist of either gender to travel overseas, which she did by leaving the colony in 1855. And over the next 11 years, she spent most of that time in Rome, training with all these elites, meeting these incredible peoples. Rome at that time was a place where there were jolly female bachelors living a life of sexual and creative freedom. She was friends with those people, and she also trained with Ruskin. So hers is an incredible story that reminds us that colonial society never, you know, colonial stories never lived only within national boundaries.
And why is it that we have Adelaide to thank for this petition? How do they kind of exist in the same world?
Great question. Well, anyone who's a colonial historian has probably read Peter Cochrane's Colonial Ambition. Great book, quite a few times. And Peter's an awesome guy. So I was reading that for about the third or fourth time. I was reading the chapter on the Hyde Park Barrack parade or protest that's associated with this petition, because it was 1850 and the star speaker was a cantankerous, controversial, dubious and dodgy figure, the Presbyterian minister John Dunmore Lang. He was a feisty character, but he had kind of adopted Adelaide as his protege. And they remained very close all their lives. And I thought, well, if Lang is there, I wonder if Adelaide was there, because she was very politically passionate. She was an outspoken Republican about Australia being a republic and also Italy. And I thought, you know, if she was there in 1850, she would have been about 20. And that would have been one of those crucible moments in her life, I reckon, where you really get your political awareness shaped. And I wanted to see if I could prove that she was there. So when I read Peter's Colonial Ambition again, suddenly this reference to a lady's petition, which was just a sentence in the description of that, just came to life to me, and I thought, well, I wonder if that still exists.
Yeah, yeah.
And could Adelaide have signed it? Could she have been a ringleader?
You're listening to Glam City on 2SER 107.3. To download this show, head to 2SER.com or your favourite podcast app and look for Glam City. This show is made by the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS with support from 2SER. And on this episode, we're talking to Glam City's own Kira Lindsay, usually a co-host, today in the hot seat. And we're talking about this quite fascinating ladies petition, to use the disparaging term, but also to use the shorter term. And we kind of left it there with a potential star signatory, Adelaide Ironside. And so, Kira, was she there?
Okay. Well, to answer that question, I want to go back in a slightly different direction again. Sorry, Chelsea. I'm one of those people who answer a question by taking the bull by the horns. But so my historical passion lies in recovering female voices from the archive. I'm really, really passionate about that. And that's what The Convict's Daughter was about. I found a deposition that told the story of my great-great-great-aunt who had run away with the Attorney General's son around this sort of time. So pretty cool story. But there was only a few sentences about her. So when I started thinking about this petition, I thought, wow, it could potentially tell a story about a whole lot of other women as well, if it existed. So I went and spoke to three archivists at the State Records of New South Wales. That was Bonnie Wild, who's a fantastic archivist, Edith Ho from the State Library of New South Wales, and also Rosemary Semple, who's at the Parliamentary Records of New South Wales, Parliamentary Archives. And we all recognised that this could be really exciting, and thought, let's start casting our web and seeing what we can find. Fortunately, there's this thing called the Australian Joint Copying Project, which has been around for quite a long time, and they have been digitising documents en masse in a lot of different areas. And they had digitised, what they often do is just digitise the first couple of pages of these things. But, and in fact, the opening address of the petition was already online.
Wow.
But no one had really sort of just, you know, I think it's that thing about history that is what excites us so much when we're doing archival research, is that often there's just this glorious moment of serendipity where the right project and question comes together, and suddenly all those dots that have been floating around in a different universe start to reassemble and get connected in a different way. And that's what happened here. So I was given some very discouraging responses from archivists in England who basically said, you got Buckley's, mate. I mean, they didn't say that.
Yeah.
But they basically said, most petitions from this time have been destroyed. You're probably not going to find it, and there's nothing here. But here it was under our nose all along. It was in the stacks, in the dusty backs of the stacks of the Parliamentary Archives of New South Wales, in a big blue box with a little number LC1 label on it.
Wow.
And Rosemary found it after I'd been looking for about 8 weeks, and I'd just given up. You know, I'd had so many discouraging emails that I was like, okay, well, I'll work with what I've got and see what I can do. And she rang me up and she said, I found it. And I was like, nah, come on, you're joking. And she's like, no. I'm like, hang on, I'm just going to sit down. So wow. I was in the next day to have a look at it.
Name Rosemary, and indeed to name the other archivists. Mm. So you also write, I'm drawing a lot on the conversation piece, not only because it's publicly accessible, so people listening to this can go and read it, but also because you spell out so beautifully, I think, the not only why the petition is important, why this document is important, but the process around this kind of archival research. And you write that this collection of papers promised a rare encounter with voices difficult to hear within the colonial archive. It's a lovely sentence. And I wondered if that, what that says or what that indicates about your process of engaging with archives more generally. And what is it about, you know, maybe uncovering or giving a space for the voices to speak that excites you or motivates you?
Was it, you know, the day I went into the Parliamentary Archives to open the blue box that Rosemary had unearthed, and sitting in her office cubicle, because I don't really have any formal place for that kind of work, and I opened the big document and turned the first page, you know, got the address and was able to look at that a little bit differently. And there are 15 signatures on that first page, and most of them are from, the first one smack bang in the middle is Lady Eleanor Stevenson. And that kind of tells you, I think, that she's played a pretty key role in it. And I suspect her handwriting might be that of the address. But when when you go through the remaining 207 pages, 206 pages, they're lined in columns of three, so there's three sections, and what you see is this fascinating collection of different female voices, which, you know, when you marry it together with the census records, which I started to look at quite closely, you can see... You can see where women are living, how they're living side by side. So you often get a moment where a whole lot of family names have been written down in quite a good hand, and then a little bit afterwards you get these wobbly hands that lack confidence, and it looks like the blokes, the collectors, knocked on the door and the women have come out to sign the document, and then they've said, get the servants forward and let's get them to sign as well. Now, that moment in itself tells you something about how gender and class are operating in this political moment. It's just a moment. You know, we can only speculate about it because I can't prove that. But when you've got a street address there as well, that gives us a little bit more information to start to look at it. Also, another thing that might help us start to think about the urban geography of Sydney, because these are Sydney signatures, is that you've often got names like Florence's and Edith's and Agnes's and Harriet's, which we would associate with a kind of perhaps an Anglican establishment culture, next to wobbly Anne's who have signed their names without confidence, or even those names that have been signed with a cross, in which case what's happened is that the signature collector has written their name and these women who are illiterate have signed with a cross. And most often those kind of women had been convicts themselves. So this again tells us that this was not an issue that excluded emancipist convict women. It was one that could involve them too.
To kind of bring our conversation to a close, it does occur to me, Dr. Kira Lindsay, that a question that I asked a little while ago has been left begging. Mm. And so I will come back to the petition to Adelaide. Was she there? Did she sign it?
You also asked me a question about speculative biography and the archives. And so I'll bring those together if that's okay.
Please do.
So to me, speculative biography is an invitation to write history that tastes like fiction. You know, so it's hopefully a good read, an exciting read. And it also invites a higher degree of speculation than sometimes we're allowed to make. It uses narrative more than argument. Peter Cochrane uses this terrific term in another piece he's written about something else, which he says that sometimes when we're writing narrative history, we can convey argument in narrative as if by stealth.
Wow.
I love that. Because I think that's what we can do. We don't have to be didactic and shove information down the throats of our readers, but we can give them things and invite them to think about whether or not this speculation holds true, but also help them to imagine being there. And that's why I write speculative biography, because I enjoy being imaginative myself and it helps me license that in myself and the readers. So the good news is that the petition will appear in my forthcoming book because, yes, Adelaide and her mother, Martha. They did sign it. They signed it on page 199 of that 207-page document. I knew once I'd seen that front page petition, the front page, that she wasn't a ringleader because her name's not there. And to find it at page 199, I think, confirms that even more. But that's terrific, Chelsea, you know, because in our history, the little bits that people know about Adelaide would position her as unusual and an exception for being politically aware colonial woman. That's how she's often been described to me and why some people discouraged me from writing a biography of her, because they thought she wasn't representative of colonial society because she was too unusual in being educated and politically interested. Well, the fact that she's on page 199, I think, tells it a new story here.
Yeah, she's one of a strong community.
One of 9,000.
Exactly.
180.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the close of Glam City for today. If you'd like to hear more from us, of course, head to the 2SER website, 2SER.com, and you can also search for us on your favourite podcast app. This podcast is made by the Australian Centre for Public History with the support of 2SER 107.3. And if you want to get in touch, please email us at glamcity@2ser.com. My sincere, lovely thanks to Dr. Kira Lindsay for taking on the role of guest today and for chatting so beautifully about an amazing collection of documents. Thank you.
Thank you, Chelsea. And again, as you said so nicely yourself, thanks to those archivists, to Edith, to Bonnie and to Rosemary for helping to light the path forward to revealing this fantastic document. I really hope it makes a difference to Australian history.
2SER stands on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we acknowledge and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. We'll be right back.